Welcome to the Power Hour. I'm Adrienne Herbert, wellness coach, international speaker, and author. Each week, I speak to a variety of guests, from business founders to Olympic athletes, leading coaches, change makers, and innovators, to find out their daily habits, their rules to live by, and what motivates them to get up out of bed each day. Personally, I am on a mission to encourage, motivate, and inspire, so I hope that the Power Hour will help you to achieve your personal and professional goals. Welcome back to the Power Hour podcast. Wow, it is almost the end of another year. Now, I know that this time of year typically can be very busy. We have social plans, work things to do, kids have a lot going on, and it can be pretty overwhelming, can be stressful, can feel like a lot of pressure. So, first thing to say is that whatever you are doing this week, whether it's Christmas parties, Christmas nativities, Christmas shopping, whatever you're doing this week, try and take a little bit of time, if you can, take an hour, take a power hour to do something for yourself. Something that is nourishing, something fun, something that is restful or re-energizing. Take that time before the end of the year. I myself, you might be able to hear my voice, I'm just recovering from a whole week of being ill. This is what happens when you live with three small children in December. It is inevitable, but I'm hoping that by next week I am going to be back 100, fighting fit and feeling great. So today's episode is the best of 2023, part one on the Power Hour, and you're going to hear from Viv Groskop. I recorded with Viv earlier this year and I absolutely loved this conversation. We talk about self-confidence, we talk about Happy High Status, which is Viv's latest book. We talk about what it means to be happy high status, to be more confident, to overcome imposter syndrome. It is an incredible, it was just such a great conversation and I felt so empowered by the end of that 1 hour. I felt like I could take on the world. You'll also hear from Dr. Anders Hansen. Now, in this episode, we talked about happiness and about what it really means to live a life that is not only happy, but to feel content and the psychology of happiness and contentment, which I thought was really, really interesting. You'll also hear from Thomas Curran. Now, we talked about the perfectionist trap and perfectionism, how perfectionism shows up in our lives, what it is, why we sometimes think perfectionism is a good thing when actually it can be very detrimental to our well-being, to our physical and mental health, and how it is a trap that we should try to avoid. And last but not least, Dr. Chris Van Tulleken. Now, in April, I recorded this episode with Dr. Chris, and it is, I think, one of the most popular episodes on the Power Hour this year, because we were talking all about ultra-processed foods. Now, I basically said after recording this episode, I said to anyone, friends, family, social media, I said, listen, if you eat bread, you need to listen to this episode. If you go to... I'm not going to say the specific brand, but if you go and you buy your lunch out every day, then maybe listen to this episode. And people really, really enjoyed it. It's all about ultra processed food and the impact that that has on our physical and mental well-being. So let's dive into the best of 2023, part one. So, simply, my first question, Viv, is how do you, or how should we, define confidence?
Well, I define it as happy high status, which is why I chose that title for this book. And obviously, the expression happy high status, three separate words, it's not an expression that anybody really knows. So it sounds like a very weird thing to choose. I first came across this expression more than 10 years ago when I was first doing stand-up comedy. So for the first part of my career through my 20s and early 30s, I was a journalist for places like The Guardian and The Observer and The Financial Times. And then in my mid-30s, I had three small children. I was having a bit of a wobble as a freelancer. It was just after the financial crash of 2008 when there's a lot of advertising going out of print media, just before everyone started being on social media, really. And I had this real moment of thinking what I've planned for my life, which is just to be a journalist, really, it's not going to exist soon. And it's all going wrong. And I've got these three kids. And how am I going to make sure that I have a, you know, good life as I get older. And I also realized, as I was telling my kids as they were growing up, to do what they want with their lives and not listen to other people, that I hadn't entirely listened to that myself. So I had this kind of like mini midlife crisis when I was about 35, 36. And I discovered stand-up as part of that, because when I was a child, I loved drama, I loved acting, I loved showing off, singing, always been a total karaoke hogger, hog the microphone at karaoke. I secretly want to be Jane McDonald, basically. That is, she is living my parallel life.
An icon.
And she's doing it brilliantly. So I always had this other side of me that I hadn't really properly acknowledged, and started messing around with it. But it became more and more serious, and I ended up kind of switching careers and doing a lot of comedy and started hosting book tours for people like Dawn French and Joe Brand. You know, through a lot of contacts I had in journalism, really, I got a quick entry into that world. So all of the time when I was first doing stand-up, I was nervous and I wasn't entirely confident. Although I am quite a confident person, you have to project such a massive confidence. Or at least confidence, you don't, you know, lots of comedians, their act is to be insecure or to be like weird or freaky or whatever. So it's not necessarily a straightforward confidence, but you need to really look as if you know what you're doing. And I very quickly came across this concept that's called happy high status. So in improv comedy, which is things like Whose Line Is It Anyway? They do lots of improv on Saturday Night Live. Tina Fey is schooled in that school of comedy. It's part of an American tradition. It's also a British tradition. And it came out of the 1950s, 60s, 70s. And this guru, who recently died, actually, Keith Johnston, founded these ideas about status on stage. And status on stage is, or even on screen, you can think about it like in terms of succession. Like, succession is a great way to think about it. So you've got this family, the father is clearly like the top dog, and then you've got these four siblings who are all vying for his attention. Sometimes they're up, sometimes they're down. And their status is not necessarily about their status in terms of their wealth, like in succession, they're all wealthy. Mm. Their status is about their emotional and psychological status in relation to each other. So this concept of status in comedy, in screen, in fiction, in all kinds of storytelling is really about who's up, who's down. And a lot of that is connected to confidence. So how confident are you to approach somebody who is supposedly intimidating or more senior than you? How confident are you when somebody comes up to you who's very needy and needs something and is putting you in a position of authority? Mm. And the idea of happy high status is that you get yourself into a zone where you're not overly confident and you're not trying to dominate other people, but you're not underconfident either. So if people asked you to lead or they needed you to lead, you could. Mm. So it's a very kind of balanced way of holding your ego in check, being confident, but not in that kind of superficial, stereotypical way of confidence that you so brilliantly described, that we've all often grown up with from childhood. It's like confident people, oh, they talk really loudly, they take up all the space in the room, they're really annoying, right? Happy high status is moving away from that stereotype and asking, what does it look like if you're comfortable in your status, in your way that you move through the world, in how you're feeling today? What does that look like? The happy part is not like happy, happy, smiley, everything's great. It means more like balanced or relaxed. So typical examples of people in the public eye who I think have this in spades, George Clooney, typical example, Michelle Obama, Barack Obama, Julia Roberts, another great example. Sometimes not great to talk about celebrities in relation to this, because we can then think, oh, well, it's easy to be happy high status if you're George Clooney. I mean, for goodness sake. But it gives you an idea, like a visual idea of what it means like to look relaxed in yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, in French, they have the expression, bien dans sa peau, well in your skin, bien dans sa peau. And there's a lot of expressions in different languages that since the book has come out, I've heard, like there's an expression in Italian, which is called sprezzatura, which again means like being comfortable in yourself.
We recognize it when we see it, don't we? We recognize it in others. And when we don't see it, I think we can often feel uncomfortable as well. We recognize both people that that do have happy high status. And sometimes I think those who really feel flustered or they have self-doubt and all of those things, and it can make you feel uncomfortable.
Yeah. The other way I use to help people visualize this is if you're comfortable with the idea of Buddhism or yoga or meditation, this is like a kind of active Zen. So you are Zen in yourself. You know, you're feeling, you're neutral, you're waiting to see what's going to happen, you're open to things. The other way of thinking about it that I use a lot is to think the opposite of petty. So when we are petty, we are not happy high status. We're like looking for somebody who's slighted us. We're looking for every little kind of snarky remark or, oh, that person looked at me funny, right? Yep. That's the opposite of this. So sometimes I will think to myself, okay, what is the happy high status response in this situation? Or how can I be more happy high status today? Mm. And sometimes I'll think, okay, what is the least petty response? Or sometimes to ask yourself, what is the most generous response? And I'm not suggesting that this is a state of being that you would manage to be in all of the time. Nobody can do that, not even Michelle Obama, right? It very interestingly, if you watch the Netflix documentary on Michelle Obama, when she is between moments of being public and being happy high status in front of other people, she listens to music. So when she's traveling between speaking engagements or TV interviews, she listens to music really loudly on her phone and she just relaxes and chills out. So she isn't trying to be happy high status all of the time. She's giving herself a break and she's recharging. So we can't be this all of the time. For example, I am not this all of the time. Last night I was at the British Podcast Awards and my podcast was nominated for a Best Business Podcast and we didn't win. And I immediately felt myself being petty when we didn't win, because I'm very competitive and I always want to win everything. And I just think, I mean, I don't literally think it only counts if you win. Of course, I don't think that. But I don't believe the platitude of like, oh, it's the taking part that counts. No, it's not. It's you try to win.
I came here.
I can feel this sort of little anger and a little gremlin inside me, you know, wanting to express this like a petulant child. And I kept thinking, Viv, come on, you need to be happy high status. You need to show grace. You need to show generosity. But another part of me was thinking, well, no, actually, it's okay to be human. Just like be angry for half an hour, have a little bitch to yourself inside your head. Like, don't let it out because other people don't want to see that it's ugly.
Okay. You weren't booing from your seat then.
No, so I didn't have like a tantrum, but I just recognized to myself, like, it's okay to be petty now and again. But most of the time, it's really going to benefit you and everyone around you if you try to incorporate more moments of this idea of happy high status. And I hope, as you suggested already, that this offers people a reset. It offers them a new way of thinking about confidence that is evidenced, you know, from these ideas of drama and stage and screen. So we recognize happy high status and status because we're reading it all the time. Anytime that we watch a drama of any kind or comedy of any kind, we're using these status ideas. We're schooled in them without realizing. So once you start to recognize this and see this everywhere, it becomes easier to embody it yourself. And you also start to move away from these stereotypical ideas of confidence that are often, I think, so toxic and hold us back. And they're so rooted in things that we've been told as children, you know, like, don't speak too loudly, or you've got fun. I've heard so many people say to me they've been told there's something weird about their voice, or that they're their accent is wrong or whatever. And it's never true. You know, most people, like, I would say, I don't think I've ever met anybody that I've thought your voice is ugly and you need to change it.
It's interesting because I would I would like to guess that many of those people are women. I think it's often women totally. That are told to change their voice. So I've heard women say before that they've actively tried to make their voice deeper or softer or less shrill. And it's quite interesting feedback, isn't it, for someone to think the tone of your voice is the tone of your voice. I think there's other things we can think about. If you speak really quickly when you're nervous, you know, slowing your down your speech is maybe different. But I think, yeah, the tone of your voice or another, I think, misconception that people probably have heard about confidence is that it's a personality trait and it's the same as extroversion, and that, oh, for example, myself, I'm an extrovert, so therefore people assume that means you're confident and that confidence and extroversion applies to all areas of your life. Whereas in my experience, I'd say I'm very confident in certain settings where I feel capable. I feel, I suppose, as you would say, happy, high status. And I know exactly what those scenarios are where I feel that, but I do not feel that in other situations and scenarios. And I actually find it difficult, this great question for you, to transfer that feeling or that skill or that happy high status into an environment or a scenario or a relationship dynamic where you know that you don't feel that. And you mentioned the Succession characters, and of course, if anyone has seen it, you know, this jostling between different dynamics of power and status can be exhausting, it can be debilitating. And I think certain relationships and certain people can almost bring that out in us and diminish, we can feel our confidence diminish. And if you recognize, actually, every time I have an interaction with that person, why do I find myself shrinking? I think it's a really complex one. What advice would you give for me or for anyone else listening who thinks, okay, in this setting, I really want to take that happy high status feeling over here, but I struggle to do that?
Yeah, I like using this idea of what I call overlay. So I used to use this sometimes when I was first starting to do stand-up, of trying to get a feeling very deep in my body through breathing, through using my memory, through visualization, through meditation. It doesn't have to take very long. You can do this for like 3-5 minutes. I used to use an app a lot that's called Buddhify that takes you through, so Buddhify. I think the app Headspace also does a similar thing. It takes you through a guided meditation that just lets you calm down. So you then have these feelings in your body of calm, of neutrality, of not expecting anything or needing anything, that very relaxed feeling that we have when we are maybe in nature, when we're with people who we don't have to pretend anything with them, like good friends, family can be a difficult one because we're often, a lot of us, triggered by difficult family members. So just think about like the family members who do make you feel really relaxed, or the friends who make you feel really relaxed, situations where you're just, there's no pressure and you're just yourself. You're not trying to be anything. And actually thinking and feeling what it is in your body to be that. Where is that in your body? A lot of us don't take the time. And I've done a lot of work with different groups of people experimenting with this, and it's in different places for different people. I'm sure people who do yoga and meditation will know this because they're in that state a lot. But for some people, that's that feeling of calm in their stomach, or they might feel very grounded through their feet, or they might feel like their heart feels very centered, or they might feel like their head feels light in a good way. It's a feeling of being grounded. So being more physical, taking things out of your mind and putting it into your body. And I mean, I'm not saying there's any science in this, by the way. This is purely stuff that I have observed and used in my own performance, right? I'm sure you could invent science around this, but I don't think you necessarily need to. if it resonates with you, great. Yeah. So take that feeling and think, what would it be like if I could feel a part of that in a very pressurized situation? And just planting the seed of that idea sometimes is enough. Sometimes you need to do something practical to overlay that feeling. So I would sometimes do breathing ahead of a difficult moment or a pressurized moment. So like I had a gig sort of quite early on in my stand-up time where I was booked for a 3-night residency somewhere. The first night went really badly. The second night went slightly better, but really not good enough better. And I had like a third chance. And I was just like, if I don't crack it on this third night, this is really not good. And so I did these breathing exercises and meditation, and I made sure that my breathing pattern was for something like, you know, four breaths in, four counts in, six counts out, that I did the same just before I went on stage. So I was trying to replicate and overlay relaxed feelings, relaxed habits from an unpressured situation into a pressured situation. And sometimes I think just the act of having thought about that, having made space for it, having acknowledged the fact that this is not to do with you being not a good enough person, or you not being in the right place, or some kind of sign from the universe that you're rubbish and should just give up in whatever situation you're in. It's all to do with our physiological reactions to pressure, which are just completely natural and normal. And very often under pressure, all that we're experiencing is a flood of adrenaline in our body. And we experience this as, oh no, run away. And really we should experience it as, oh wow, I'm alive.
Well, if you look on, if you Google the word happiness, you will get more than 900 million results. And there seems to be as many versions of what happiness is. Many look at happiness as feeling good all the time, basically. And if you think that is happiness, then you will be disappointed, because that's not how the brain works. We are not built to feel good all the time. The brain never evolved to be happy. It didn't evolve to be creative or intelligent. It evolved to keep us alive, to take us to tomorrow alive. So feelings of to feel good is something that should be short term. Otherwise, we would not be motivated to carry on. And to not be motivated was meant death for 99% of all humans, of all previous generations of humans. So to feel good all the time, that's a completely unrealistic. But I look at happiness as having a good, thinking that your life has a positive, a good long-term direction, that you're doing something that contributes. And that's the definition of happiness that is often used in psychiatric research. And that's, I think it's important that you have such a definition, because if you think that happiness means that you will feel good all the time, then you will compare yourself against a goal that is completely unrealistic. We are not built that way, but we are led to believe that in advertisement and so on. I know that Coca-Cola had an ad where they said, open up to happiness, or open happiness. And the message that they're sending to billions of people is that happiness is something that you choose. And if you don't feel it, then there's something wrong with you. And, you know, that's the problem. You compare yourself to a goal that is completely unrealistic. And I think a better advertisement would be to say that it's okay to feel down all the time, sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's okay to feel crappy, because then you would compare yourself to a goal that is actually realistic. But such a phrase would probably not sell so many soft drinks. So we will not see that. But the modern view of happiness is, in most cases, completely unrealistic. Mm-hmm. And we pay a price for that.
You mentioned a word then that I wanted to pause on. You said choose. You said we're told that happiness is something that we choose. Now, I'd love you to kind of correct me, I guess, on where I'm going wrong, because I sometimes have thought that in the past. I've thought, you know, I've listened to a lot of speakers, a lot of audiobooks and things on this topic. And I've kind of thought about that as about perspective and about, you know, you choose to see the world in this way, or you choose to focus on positive things. Or, you know, as you said, if you're feeling crappy, if you're feeling down, we all have challenges in life. Maybe your job is stressful. Maybe your kids aren't behaving. Maybe you have an ill parent. And sometimes we can feel like, you know what, I just need to be more grateful, or I just need to be more optimistic, and I have to choose happiness. So yeah, am I getting that wrong in terms of trying to cultivate a mindset that is optimistic when maybe that's not helpful?
I mean, of course that can be important, no question about that, but it's not that simple, really. It goes back to what I said about the brain. It never evolved to be happy or smart. It evolved to take us to tomorrow alive. And the most important thing I never learned about the brain in med school was that it has not changed during the last 10,000 years. we are still adapted to a life as hunters and gatherers. And for 99.9% of all the time on the planet for humanity, half of all humans died before they became teenagers. And they did not die from what we die to from today, such as cancer and cardiovascular disease. They died from infections, bleeding, murder, and accidents, starvation. Those were the things that killed people. And we are the descendants of the ones who did not die from that, of course, because we have behind us an unbroken line of survivors. And that means that we have in us, in our brains, and in our bodies, defense mechanisms against the things that killed us in the past. And one such defense mechanism is to see the world as dangerous, because this was a terribly dangerous world that shaped us. And to see danger everywhere helped you survive. It helped you to prepare for the worst. To see danger everywhere today, that's what we call anxiety. And from this perspective, it's not surprising that people have anxiety. What is surprising is that there are some people who don't have anxiety, and maybe they should be diagnosed. and when I say that to my patients, some of them say that I really get it now. I am not damaged. I am not broken. I'm not damaged goods, so to speak. So if you contain the way you view anxiety or stress is very important, because it can make you seem like a broken person, damaged, or it could be seen as something completely normal. And that's why it's so important to learn about the brain if you want to understand your mental life. And you will also understand that things like think positively and be calm and happy and so on, such cliches, you know, they don't work most of the time, because evolution builds much stronger mechanisms than ones that can be just fooled around by some simple cliches. Mm. It isn't that simple. So I'm not saying that you shouldn't cultivate a positive view. You should, of course, but you should also learn about our biology and learn that the things that we call anxiety and depressive episodes are defense mechanisms that shows that we are functioning. They don't show that we are broken. Mm. If they cause you a lot of problems, you should seek help, because seeking help is a sign of strength. And you don't say to a diabetic, for instance, pull up your blood sugar. You just don't do that. So you can't say to a person who's suffering from a depression, pull yourself up or think positive things or whatever. It's not that simple. Mm. So we have to break the stigma and realize that we are not built to feel good all the time.
Yeah, and I think that is incredibly powerful when you describe it like that, comparing it to a physical health complaint. So much of mental health and mental illness, as you described, is spoken about in that way, which makes us think that we have the capabilities to change it, and that we have to do it ourselves, and it's about us, and we have to fix it. And that, I think, is very problematic. So for anyone listening in there, maybe thinking, okay, I know a little bit about mental health and mental illness, and they try to do a routine and daily habits and things to support that. So, for example, getting adequate sleep, or, you know, exercising regularly, or, you know, listening to music that they like. But we all have ups and downs. And, you know, I recently heard somebody describing, I thought it was brilliant, they talked about the vibration frequency. And you know how you might have seen online, sometimes people have this phrase, good vibes only. Have you seen that before?
No, I haven't.
Oh, well, I've seen this quite a lot. Sometimes, I think it was an Instagram thing, people would say, oh, good vibes only. And it means, like, you know, we're only going to allow good energy, you know, happy people, like good vibes, no stress, no drama. So the sentiment, I think, is nice. But essentially what he said was, if you think about a vibration, you know, with music or anything, you can't have only the up vibration. If something goes up, down, up, down, up, down, that's what vibration is. That's what energy is. That's what frequency is. So this idea that we could have good vibes only, we can only have up in life, you know, it's not possible. We have to have up, no. We have to have down. But also, sometimes people feel as though they're stuck in the down. You know, they might feel like every single day they are stuck, they're unhappy. So if someone is experiencing that right now and they feel stuck, they feel like they're stuck in the down, do you have any, I suppose, where should people start with something actionable that they could do maybe today, maybe a daily practice, to start to shift out of that feeling of feeling stuck in the down?
Yes, and I mean, if you are stuck feeling down, that's a depression, or could be a mild depression, it could be a severe depression, but you should seek help for it. That's my first advice. And there are different forms of help. Cognitive therapy is very good. We know that exercise is incredibly important for mood regulation, but it's very difficult to exercise if you feel down, of course. And we also know that we know that antidepressant medication works. So my main advice there is to seek help. But the point that you make is so important that we can't feel good all the time because the brain wants to motivate us to do things. And why is this? Well, we are still adapted to life like hunters and gatherers. And let's assume that one of our ancestors was climbing a tree to pick some bananas. And then she managed to do that and get those, and she ate the bananas. She felt happy, she felt good. Now, how long could she do feel good? Well, not too long, because if she felt good for 2 months, then she will starve to death. She would not continue striving for any new bananas. So positive feelings should, by definition, be short term to motivate us, because that's our feelings are motivations. That's the brain's tools for motivating us to do things that kept us alive and helped us reproduce in a setting that we used to live, not in today's world. So the consequence of this is that the brain wants to really remain in balance. If you push the dopamine system, the reward system in the brain, too much, it will adapt to that, and it will stop producing its own dopamine and the dopamine receptors that the dopamine plugs into in the brain, and there will be fewer of them. So the brain realizes that, oh, I get all this dopamine from the outside by my smartphone or by alcohol or cocaine or whatever, and then it stops producing its own, and it starts to expect this high level, and it doesn't get that. Everything feels incredibly boring. So the consequence of this is what was great yesterday is something that you expect today and something that will be not enough tomorrow. So that's another reason why you should perhaps be a bit moderate on how much pleasure you seek, because if you seek it too much, too intensely, it will backfire. All hedonism will unfortunately lead to anhedonia.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I think the best place to start actually would be to discuss, so the title of the book, Ultra Processed People, I'd really love if you could define for us what ultra processed food is, because I think some people might be surprised. Often the assumption about ultra processed food is that it's just junk food. So high sugar, high fat food, such as ice cream or deep fried chicken. Mm-hmm. And it's fair to assume that most people know when they eat these kind of foods that they're highly processed, but they might not consider that their breakfast granola is ultra processed, or that their lunchtime salad wrap might be ultra processed. So I think it's the best place to start. Could you tell us what is the definition of an ultra processed food?
So it's such a great point, because so much of it is obvious junk, but there's masses of ultra processed food that is organic. It's associated with weight loss. It's low fat. It's ethical. It's allegedly good for us. There's a very long formal definition, which you can look up on the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization website. But it boils down to this: if it's wrapped in plastic and it contains at least one ingredient that you don't typically find in a domestic kitchen, like an emulsifier or a colorant or a flavoring, then it is an ultra processed food. So it's a pretty straightforward way of looking at it. You just go to the supermarket, look at the ingredients, and if there's something there you don't recognize, then it is UPF.
Yeah, and I think it's pretty shocking, actually, that often we don't really know what is in the foods that we eat. Because when you describe it like that, you say, OK, if you open it out of a packet, it's probably processed. And people might think, yeah, but I don't eat that much ultra processed food. But honestly, when you start reading the book and you start breaking it down, you realise you probably eat more ultra processed food than you think. So, for example, if you read the ingredients of the back of something and the ingredients are listed, it's pretty useless if you don't know what you're reading. So, for example, if it says modified starch, or like you said, emulsifier, or hydrogenated oil, if you don't know what modified starch is or emulsifier is, then how can we make an informed decision about whether or not we should be eating it?
That's such an important point. I mean, a really good rule of thumb is, if you don't know what it is, then it's almost certainly an ultra processed ingredient. And there's a really important thing here to separate out processed food, which is fine, and ultra processed food. So I think of this in terms of milk. If we start with milk, milk is a whole food. You can drink it straight out of the cow or the goat or the sheep, wherever you get your milk. And that's what we call a whole food. Now, you can process it into cheese or butter, and those products are fine as well. They're not associated with diet-related disease. The science is clear that cheese and butter are fine. You can ultra process your butter into margarine. And this is what ultra processed food is. It's fake versions of real food. So processing is fine. Humans have been processing food, which includes cooking, grinding, extracting, frying, pounding, grinding. All that is processing. We've been doing it for over a million years. It's a really important part of our diet. In fact, humans can't survive without processing food. We have to cook our food. You can't live on raw food. And there's a lot of people have tried, and you can't do it. But ultra processing is a set of industrial processes. Some of them are physical, so you're grinding and extruding food. Some of them are thermal. You cook things at high temperature, or you bleach, refine them, hydrogenate them. Lots of them are chemical. And then you take those foods that have been processed and you add lots and lots of additives to make them edible and more palatable. And so ultra processed food, the purpose of it is profit. And that is in that very long formal scientific definition. Is this is food not about nourishing the human body, it's about generating profit for the transnational food corporations. And that's important.
Yeah, very important. We're going to come on to talk about that a little bit later on, actually, when it comes to, yeah, why there's so much ultra processed food in the food system, why it is, you know, we'll talk about the cost part. But forgive me if this seems like an obvious question, but why should people be, you know, people listening to this podcast right now, why should they be concerned about how much ultra processed food is in their diet? So is it the problem that there's an absence of whole foods in your diet, or is it the presence of ultra processed food that causes an issue?
So that is a question that people have worked really, really hard to answer. The definition of ultra processed food was developed as a hypothesis about 13 years ago by a team in Brazil in 2010. And the hypothesis that what they were trying to do was describe the set of industrial foods that seem to be driving diet-related disease. So that's strokes, heart attacks, metabolic disease like type 2 diabetes, and early death, as well as lots of cancers. And so they came up with this definition. And then over the last decade, we've done a huge amount of research trying to figure out, was the hypothesis true? Is ultra-processed food associated with disease and death? And the studies are really, really clear that the association is very, very strong. So that in 2019, we realized, there was a study that came out in The Lancet, where we realized that diet was the leading cause of early death on Earth for human beings. It had overtaken tobacco. And ultra-processed food is the way of defining what a poor diet is. And when we look at the data from the big population studies, it's not simply that this food is fatty and salty and sugary, and it's not simply that this food is displacing real food from the diet. It is partly that. It is that this food itself is harmful, and it's harmful in a huge number of different ways.
Well, I think it's interesting to highlight that, because if I think about myself anecdotally, I knew that I was going to be having this conversation with you today. And as I said, reading the book recently, thinking about, okay, what things am I buying, especially when you're traveling, because you're not in your own kitchen and cooking. So anecdotally, the reason I ask is because yesterday I was thinking, okay, what have I eaten today and how much of the food I'm eating is whole food, how much of it's ultra processed, and yeah, is it kind of the case that, okay, if it's 5 to 1, is that a good ratio? So I'll start off like in the morning. I won't bore you with my entire day of what I ate, but
no, do it.
Well, in the morning I got up, I had a banana really early. I think it was before 6 o'clock, had a banana, fine. About 2 hours later, I knew that me and my husband were going to be going out for a run. We're doing the London Marathon very soon. It was a short run and I thought, actually, I'm really hungry. I'm going to have a decent breakfast. So I had a fried egg with some rocket, half an avocado and a seeded bagel. So before 10 a.m., I'm looking at that and I'm thinking, okay, banana, whole food, the egg, like you say, processed because I fried it, rocket, great, avocado, great. And then the bagel, which is seeded, is ultra processed food, right? So I'm looking at that and thinking it's kind of like, yeah, 6 to 1, 5 to 1, whatever. If I continued my entire day, as I said, I won't bore you with it, but in the evening I had, you know, a glass of red wine. I had some salted pistachios. I had these wasabi crackers that I got in Japan. They're ultra processed. And I was trying to like balance it out. And that's why I asked you about this. Is it the absence of, so for example, if someone says, well, it's fine, Adrienne, because you eat fruits and vegetables and you eat, you know, protein, and you eat all these things and you cook your food from scratch most of the time. So what if there's an ultra processed bagel or a few biscuits or, and so yeah, is that kind of, is there a ratio people can figure it out? Or is it the case that actually all ultra processed food is bad and having it in your diet is going to cause issues for you?
So I think different listeners need different answers. There may be people, I'm guessing you know your demographic, and I'm guessing your audience is a pretty health motivated group who probably aren't eating a huge amount of ultra processed food. However, there will be people who are listening who are living with obesity or living with overweight or living with other diet related disease. And for those people, it may be helpful to think of ultra-processed food as a set of broadly addictive substances. And this was my relationship with it. So I have all the genetic risk factors for obesity. I have an identical twin who lived with significant obesity for a long time. And I found that there are certain ultra-processed products that I had a really problem relationship with. You know, I'd spend time thinking about them. I'd go and spend a lot of money on them. I would eat them to vast excess in spite of knowing they were bad for me. So for me, it's been really easy to go, look, I'm just not going to eat this. For me, it's like alcohol is to someone who has a problem with alcohol addiction, or cigarettes to a smoker. But there are plenty of people with alcohol who can go and have a couple of glasses of wine a week. Some people can smoke a few cigarettes on a Friday night and not think about them on a Monday morning. So those people, I think, we have to be really careful when we're talking about this. There are some people who are going to find it useful to be abstinent, and other people who, you know what, you're having the odd chocolate bar, don't sweat about it any more than you would sweat about having a glass of beer or I mean, I don't want to ever say that a cigarette is fine, but the data shows that if you're going to smoke one cigarette a week for a few years in your early 20s, it's the addiction is the problem, not the single item. So it's very much different approaches for different people. In your case, I mean, you're someone who I'd be like, you should not be neurotic about this, right? Like, I've listened to your podcast, I've followed what you do, I've seen interviews with you, I know you're a runner. The fact that you ate an ultra-processed bagel, it's not going to dramatically change your microbiome or affect your marathon performance. And it may also, it's worth saying, did you check the ingredients on that bagel? Is it like, do you know that it was ultra-processed? Or because you can buy bagels that are fine, they're just wheat and water.
Yeah, I did, especially as I said, because I knew having this conversation with you, it wasn't from my local bakery. I won't say the brand, but it was, you know, lots of different ingredients on there, and I buy them quite frequently and they're delicious. And I think, you know what, looping back to what you said, of course, yes, I'm someone who's very physically active. I try to, you know, have a balanced diet. I try to sleep well. I'm very privileged in the sense that I have access and education. And like I said, we'll talk about costs in a little bit. But I think it's interesting that also you mentioned weight and saying people living with obesity or living with overweight, but sometimes we look at that as maybe like the defining outcome of health, which as we know is not the only one. So for people who might say, oh, well, I'm slim and oh, yeah, I'm running or I go to the gym, or people might assume that, oh, well, you can eat ultra processed food and it's not bad for you because they're slim, when actually, as we know, it probably impacts things like sleep or brain fog, concentration, gut health. So, yeah, I suppose with the ultra processed foods, if let's say someone's diet is like 50-50, they say, yeah, 50% of the time, I mean, whole foods, but half the time, because I'll be honest, some days mine probably tips way more the other way. So it might be that I've had a croissant in the morning instead of that banana. It might be that I've had, I don't know, gone out for a Thai and I love, you know, noodles, and I'm sure I've had, you know, spring rolls, fried foods, like loads of the foods are probably ultra processed. And just because you're slim, from the outward appearance, someone says, oh, eat what you want. Surely there's more to consider than just the size of our waistline.
That is definitely true. And the science is very clear. When we look at, say, the risk of early death, so the most important outcome of all, arguably, when we look at the statistics of the data, it's independent of weight gain, i.e. exactly as you say, if someone like you who is, you know, young and active and doesn't have a genetic predisposition to obesity, we don't imagine, if you eat a very high ultra-processed food diet, which many fit, young, athletic people do, you are still putting yourself at increased risk of all those diet-related diseases. And this may affect different minority group populations differently. So particularly in South America or in migrant populations in the UK, we might see different risks for metabolic disease like type 2 diabetes, for example. And so we could have someone who was slim, but because of their diet was massively increasing their risk of a disease for which they already have a genetic propensity.
Perfectionism is a personality characteristic that I think a lot of people listening can identify with. It's the most common answer to that dreaded interview question, what's your biggest weakness? Oh, I'm a total perfectionist. And in many ways, this is kind of indicative of a sort of cultural perception, I suppose, that perfectionism is our favorite flaw. And although these are kind of amusing anecdotes we can point to, my research is actually showing that perfectionism is indeed becoming more common. It's risen by about 40% since the late 1980s. But as I talk about in the book, this is not necessarily something to celebrate, because I think we're quite mistaken if we think perfectionism is healthy or positive, because at root, it's a form of deficit thinking. So it comes from a sense that we're not enough, and that we need to be perfect, or at least appear perfect, in our daily lives. So it's about hiding and trying to conceal our shortcomings. And as a consequence, it can be linked to a whole host of psychological difficulties. So perfectionism is really something I think we can all identify with, but it might not necessarily be the kind of positive thing we think it is.
So yeah, it's pretty complex, but looping back to what you said about job interview questions, because you're right, I'm sure a lot of people will probably think that is a good thing to say to a potential employer, oh, I'm an absolute perfectionist, because they might assume that means, they're inferring that they're going to work really hard, they're going to go the extra mile, they're going to, you know, pay attention to detail, they're never going to miss anything. So for the employer, maybe they're thinking, oh great, this person's a perfectionist, they're going to work their butts off. So why is it that we think that it's a positive thing when it comes to output and when it comes to our work?
I think society celebrates perfection. I think in modern society, and we have a very hyper-competitive world, there's a lot of pressure to excel in school and college and in the workplace, and of course social media as well puts a lot of pressure on people to live up to really high and in many cases unattainable ideals. So the whole world that we live in right now is kind of focused around hyper functioning, hyper competitiveness. And I think that really seeps down into our own psychology. And we think that our employers looking for nothing but perfection. We think that society looks for nothing but perfection either. And when, you know, we see perfection and perfection all around us, it's quite natural, quite understandable, logical, that we would give off a sense that we will go above and beyond. We will sacrifice ourselves. We will shoot for excessively high standards in our roles because we think that's what other people are looking for. So for me, we radiate perfection because the world radiates perfection. And I don't think it's any surprise. And I think it's completely understandable that we kind of project our personalities in that way.
Yeah, I guess as the eternal optimist that I am, and someone who definitely, you know, I read a lot and talk a lot about high performance, so about, you know, optimization, and not necessarily to this standard as you're describing of, you know, unreachable extreme kind of perfection, but encouraging myself and others to think, how can we, yeah, optimize and improve things and iterate things. But is there, I suppose, some upside to perfectionism? Is there any times in our lives when it can be beneficial, or is it always detrimental?
So I think this is a really important question, and one I tried to deal with in my book to make a distinction between perfectionism and other things that are absolutely positive. So I think the kind of blind faith we put in perfectionism right now is misplaced, because one of the things you hear when you talk to perfectionists, and particularly perfectionists that are really struggling, so perfectionists perhaps that go to therapy, or perfectionistic students perhaps that come to me and ask for help, is that they feel like the perfectionism is the one thing that's holding them up in the world when everything else seems to be collapsing around them. It's my perfectionism is what's keeping me going. It's pushing me forward. It's helping me to succeed. And I think we need to understand that perfectionism isn't doing those things, that actually it's the orchestrator of those things, is what's creating those difficulties in the first place. Because as I mentioned before, it's this deficit thinking that keeps concealing, hiding, grinding, pushing forward in a way that shows other people that we're perfect and nothing but perfect. And that is rather different, for example, to things like conscientiousness or meticulousness, traits that we often confuse perfectionism with, which are active and optimistic ways of striving that are rooted in things like excellence and doing our level best. Okay, that is very different to perfectionism, because conscientious people who are meticulous, they can let things go when things aren't quite right. Perfectionists can't let things go when they aren't quite right, because the fear and social judgment is so extreme that they will continue to hide, continue to conceal, continue to push themselves well beyond comfort, because the consequence of not doing so is so difficult psychologically. So we need to make a very clear distinction between perfectionism on the one hand, which is extremely negative, and other more positive traits that you alluded to in your question there, which are rooted in things like conscientiousness, diligence, meticulousness, because I think that's really important to understanding why perfection is so damaging, and why there are other more healthier ways to strive.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting as a parent, you know, I'm listening to that as well and thinking about how, you know, how we parent and our parenting styles, and how I think, you know, often people will say that if you're a perfectionist, you know, it's because your parents were perfectionists, or they expected perfection from you, and maybe they forced you to do things, or, you know, maybe 99% wasn't good enough. I remember a friend actually telling me that, you know, if he got 99%, he joked that it's from an Indian family, and his parents had very high expectations academically for him and his siblings, and he would joke that if he got 99% on a test, it would be not good enough. Whereas I'm sure in other households, 99% would have been celebrated. So yeah, I guess for any parents listening, if they're thinking, oh yeah, you know, I want my children to strive to achieve their best, I want them to be conscientious and diligent, but am I putting too much pressure on them? Is this going to cause perfectionism traits in them? How do parents find that balance?
Well, again, it goes back to that distinction between perfectionists coming from a sense of deficit, from a sense of lack, from this idea that if you don't get perfection, then there is something wrong with you. Like, there's something wrong. If I don't get 100%, then I'm flawed in some way. I think that is a very important way to think about perfection as a starting point, because then you can begin to think, well, you know, okay, how do we interact with our kids in a way that avoids instilling these kind of deficit feelings? Well, the most important way for me is unconditional love and attention and affection, even when things have gone wrong. So what we see with warm and unconditionally affectionate parenting is that parents who will congratulate children when they've done well, praise their effort, But also when things haven't gone quite right, still praise, effort, love, and provide unconditional affection. Because this, in this way, young people and children in particular don't get a sense that their whole sense of self and their sense of self-esteem is tied to how well they're doing in the eyes of other people. Because if there's unconditionality in terms of love and affection, then children have a much build a much healthier approach to striving, which basically says, okay, well, even if I succeed or if I don't succeed, the most important thing is that I tried. The most important thing is I can learn and develop from this experience, and that my sense of worth in the world is not tied to those outcomes. I can get a sense of pride. I can get a sense of self-esteem from in putting myself in positions where I'm working hard and I'm doing tests and exams and I'm getting results back and I'm getting information about how I'm doing, but my self-esteem isn't tied to the outcomes of those outcomes. And I think for parents, that's a really, really crucial thing to bear in mind when you're communicating with your kids about exam scores, performances and things like sports or music or whatever it might be, is that no matter how things turn out, it's so, so important to be supportive and unconditionally affectionate, because those things will create much healthier ways of striving and avoid perfectionistic tendencies creeping into young people's lives.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.